Okay, shall we begin? Shall we begin? So you guys are the same. If you could squeeze in a little bit, there's still people at the back looking for a place to sit. Maybe if just a couple of you would squeeze in, fill the empty seats, that'd be great. So I told you that I would be saying a bit today about the quiz, the test, the exam, whatever we're calling it, that we're having a week from today. So let me describe that to you. At the very beginning of the class, very first lecture, I told you in general terms what this would be like. Now let me get a little more specific. So there will be three parts to the exam. The first part will be slide identification. It is necessary. You can't talk about architecture, you can't think about architecture, unless you know some rudimentary facts about architecture. So we just need to know buildings, you know, architects, a little bit of that. Only 20% of the test, and it'll be slide identification. So there will be a slide up on the screen. Half of you will have a yellow test, half of you will have a white test. One of the slides will be for the yellow test, one of the slides will be for the white test. So you'll look at those, the image appropriate to your test, and then you will have a sheet of paper that has the list of all of the architects who have been on your handouts all semester, and all of the building names that have been on your handout all semester. So you won't have to come up with the name, you won't have to spell it. All you'll have to do is for the building name, you put the number of that building. For the architect name, you put the letter of that architect. Just slide it right in there in the appropriate spot. 100%, you're done. So that is 20 points out of the 100 points in the exam. I will tell you that probably there will be about a 90 to 95% success rate on that part of the exam. That will be the easiest part of the exam for most of you because you have fantastic visual memories. But that doesn't mean you don't have to go back and review. But usually, your generation, you're good at visual memory. Played all those video games, got that visual memory down. And the way you could do that, all of those images are in the PowerPoints on the website. You have access to that. You're only responsible for those buildings that are on the list. If I showed other buildings, don't worry about it. I'm not going to be responsible for that. So that's part one. Part two is 10 multiple choice questions. 5 of them are on the book, and 5 of them are on the lecture. And I mentioned earlier, these are not like black and white multiple choice. You got to think a little bit about these. They require some knowledge, not just regurgitate a fact. I'll warn you about that in advance. Let me tell you how I would study for that if I were you. In the book, I would absolutely look for those things that are overlaps between the book and the lectures. In fact, all 5 of those questions, they were dealt with in the book and they're dealt with in the lecture. They're dealing with a subject area that was dealt with in both. So, for example, at the beginning of Rasmussen's book, he has this wonderful little story about these kids playing on the steps of Santa Maria Maggiore. And their activities are being very much formulated by the physical environment around them, but they're completely unconscious of it. The physical environment is affecting them, but they're not conscious of it. We said exactly the same thing in class. When he's talking about something we talked about in class, this is a good possibility for a quiz question. Another example, actually in the lecture today, we're going to be talking about organic sources of form, and I'm going to show you some furniture as examples of how the organic shapes of our body find their way into organic shapes in furniture. In the chapter on solids and cavities, he's really making that point with our body as a solid and a chair as a cavity that receives our body. And the fact that we talk about in chairs, they have legs and they have seats and they have backs and they have arms. Just like we have legs and seats and backs and arms, it's the same point that he's making as the point we'll be making in the lecture today. So when he's talking about the same kind of thing we talked about in class, that's a place to really pay attention. Last time we looked at Leonardo's ideal man. He talks about Leonardo's ideal man, and he has an illustration of it. That should really sharpen you up. When you're reading that part of it, pay attention to those things where there's repeats between class and the book. And then, of course, there are lots of architects that we talk about and that he talks about, and those examples, when he's talking about an architect that we've discussed in class, pay particular attention there. For example, he has two or three pages on Palladio's Villa Foscari. We talked about Palladio's Villa Rotonda. It was a major example in the lecture on systems and order. Okay, he's talking about Palladio. We're talking about Palladio in class. That's a good potential quiz question. Le Corbusier, my gosh, he has five or six Corb buildings. He's a big Corb fan. We looked at Ronchamp by Le Corbusier. We looked at Villa Sarabai and Ahmedabad by Le Corbusier. You should be paying attention in particular to those examples that Le Corbusier did, because that's someone we talked about in class. Same is true for Mies van der Rohe. We had a whole long segment in the early part of the semester. We talked about the Farnsworth House. He talks about the Tugendhat House. No, but he's still making a lot of the same points we made in class. So these overlaps are places where you should really pay attention in the book. Then on the lectures, I again told you this early in the semester, when I start enumerating things, like last time when we were talking about geometrical sources of form, and I said there are five different reasons why this is provoked in architecture, and it's like mysticism and prestige and makes structural sense and intellectual puzzles and makes a building iconic. I'd make sure I knew all of those and how that really was the framework for making the point in that lecture. Today, likewise, we'll be talking about sometimes organic sources of form come from a region, sometimes they come from a site, sometimes they come from function and physiognomy. Those three major things, those are important possibilities for a quiz question. Also, don't forget about those early lectures. We're going to have a substantial number of the questions are on the five lectures on form, but there will be a little bit on those earlier intro lectures, so just don't forget about them. In particular, if it's something that kind of reiterated itself through the other lectures, like we talked about how architecture is an indeterminate equation. How do you find that extra other thing that makes it into a solution to the problem? And we've then talked about how you do that, say, with systems and order and other things through the other lectures. So when I talk about an early lecture and it comes up again, that's a really good possibility for a quiz question. Okay, so that's part number two, 10 questions, 3 points each, total of 30 points. And then today you got this extra handout that is essay questions for quiz number one. You are to go out and look at these buildings and think about them in terms of the things we've been discussing in class. You are super welcome to have discussion with everybody. I mean, I'd encourage you to go out and look at these buildings in small groups. If you have friends in the class, go out there and look at it together and bounce ideas back and forth. And, you know, somebody says something, that's crap, that didn't make any sense to me. And then formulate your own ideas and your own perspective on what is the right answer to that question. You don't know, you don't get to choose which of those five questions. I choose two of those questions. You don't know which ones they're going to be. I'll ask you those two questions on the quiz, and you answer them. Okay. That's 50 points. Each of those essay questions is worth 25 points. And as you'll be able to see from that, if you went on the tour of the campus last Saturday, that's going to be very helpful, because we talked about some of those things. But don't just regurgitate what I said on that. I mean, these are different questions. So if there are a bunch of facts that were talked about on the tour, don't just send me back facts. Look at what the question asks you to analyze, and it's going to require you to think about that building in maybe a slightly different way than we were looking at it when we were walking around on the tour. Okay, anybody got any questions on the test? Yes? No. You have to have those thoroughly embedded in your mind. And when you come to the Okay? And you have to go see them. I mean, it's about experiencing them in real three-dimensional life, not images. So you come to class prepared with that image burned in your brain, that building burned in your brain. There are actually, we used to use Facebook. We don't use Facebook much anymore, but people would take a bunch of pictures and put them up on Facebook. And, you know, that was a way of, I think taking photos sometimes is a way for burning that into your brain. So, but it's all about visiting the building. It's not about looking at a picture of the building. Any other questions? Okay. So, Twitter card question last time. Oh my God, amazing responses to this one. I thought this was a pretty hard one, but people came up with great things. So we were looking at numbers, mathematics, and geometry as a source of form in architecture. And I ask you, in your experience, can you think of buildings that are particularly generated by numbers, mathematics, and geometry? And these are some of the answers people gave. There are a series here that people understood immediately that their culture, Islamic culture, has tons of geometry in it. And so there were a number of really great responses that had to do with Islamic architecture. So someone says, I have noticed masjids and Islamic architecture generally is very geometric in nature. This arises partly from Islam's prohibition of depicting living forms. Masjids I have been to all my life have beautiful geometry which expresses a sort of divinity through its infinite and kaleidoscopic nature. Beautifully stated. Someone else says, the design of the haram space at Mecca is mysterious. This is the most sacred spot in Islam, in Mecca. It is a perfect cube in the center surrounded by a circle. The district around that area is built on extensions of that circle, like they all face this one cube in the center, which Muslims believe is the house of God. So that mystery we were talking about in medieval buildings, very much embedded in the religion, the religious expression, kind of mysterious religious expression in Mecca. Someone else says, over spring break, I visited the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, Turkey. Similar to most other mosques, it was characterized by domes and arches. But just the sheer size of the mosque, combined with the beautiful colors, gave it a wonderful geometric order in the center of a busy, haphazard-feeling city like Istanbul. That difference between the kind of ad hoc, loose, circumstantial city, and then this moment when everything crystallizes into kind of perfect geometry. Whoa, powerful statement. Someone else says, when I visited Spain over the summer, I toured the Alhambra. Every aspect of the ancient building was rooted in geometry and the Fibonacci sequence, making it truly awe-inspiring. It combined mysticism with prestige to create an unbelievably iconic structure that represented the Muslim culture of the time. Then there were many other really good examples, not from Islamic architecture. For example, someone says the geometry of the Washington Monument creates such an iconic form, radiating the sense of power and control that should be present in Washington, D.C. Just as Eisenman's sacrifice functioned for geometric form, the monument's only real use is to display itself and represent the power of D.C. Someone else says, I went to the Guggenheim Museum when I was 12 years old, and while I enjoyed looking at the art exhibits, I was fascinated by the structure of the building. I couldn't comprehend how it was in the shape of a perfect circle and spiral all the way down. Its geometric design made other buildings dull in contrast. Boy, Frankie would love to hear that. That's just what he was after. Everything else in New York is dull in contrast. A few years ago, I visited Chichen Itza on a trip, and it was magnificent. Chichen Itza is one of the Mayan sites in Yucatan in Mexico. The pyramid itself was pure geometry, equilateral triangles on a square base. Each side has 91 steps, and on the top there was one, equaling 365. Each side represented a different season of the year also. It was beautiful. Someone else says the arch in St. Louis, Missouri is very strongly based on geometry. Not only does an arch inherently make structural sense, but it becomes iconic in what it represents to the city, a gateway to the West. When you travel to the keystone of the arch, you feel the prestige of being a citizen of St. Louis. So, excellent, excellent examples. And today we're kind of doing a corollary lecture to that one, where we're looking at geometry as a source of form. And today we're looking at nature and biology and organisms as an important source of form. We're going to be looking at several things inherent in architecture that make it responsive to organic things. One thing is certainly that often architecture is made of organic or natural materials. And if it understands the nature of those materials, it often reflects the way they were formed or the way they make structural sense. And that may well look like their embodiment in nature. So sometimes it's materials that kind of make a building more organic. Sometimes, as I just mentioned, it's things about a region, about the way that geography works that inspires sources of form. Sometimes it's a particular site or characteristics of a site that inspire organic or natural forms in buildings. And sometimes it's the fact that we, in fact, are organisms, and that as we live in buildings, maybe it makes sense for them to take on shapes or forms or characteristics that are in our physiognomy or in the way we move or in ourselves as natural beings. So the first example we want to look at on this is just extremely, extremely basic and primitive. This is a very interesting area in central Turkey where they have houses and whole cities, in fact, that are just hollowed out of the rock. So they really are making the building a cavity in the rock. And you can see how it's extremely soft. It's called tufa stone. You can even take like a spoon and just scrape away at it. It's kind of sandy. So it's very easy to excavate. And these buildings would have been done in 200, 300 AD. They're ancient buildings. And they would have been places where whole towns were created. Sometimes they went down into the ground and there would be large subterranean carving out of space down there. But you can see how these whole villages are being built. And then inside, a lot of times they're actually taking the shape of, say, on the slide on the left, someone sleeping. So what is the right shape or form of me lying down to sleep? And then when I sit up in the bed, I might need a little higher space in the middle where I sit up, but in a little bit lower space on the sides. And that, of course, is the same shape that the tufa stone works well structurally. It carries those loads around. And now it's not really geometric. It's very rough and crude and organic, but it is simply noticing the materials, the function, our physiognomy, and those rooms and those spaces and those subsets are all being created just very organically and responsively to that. And we can see this in many other accoutrements in various cultures. This is in Thailand, in Bangkok. And originally Thailand was built as a city on the water. Sometimes we call it the Venice of the East. That's a stupid thing because they were doing it completely independent of Venice. So the whole city was built around waterways. And those waterways were organic. They were originally riverways, and then they made canals and umbilicals off of that. And the water, this fluid thing, became very much a form-making device of the city. And then you can see some of the actual, they have houseboats that they live on here frequently. And you can see that those structures of course, they had to move through the water, so that's going to give them a more hydrodynamic shape and a more organic shape. And they said, okay, at the top we have to get the rain off here, and that's a very natural shape to just shed the rain, and those forces of nature are then making the shape of the boat and the shape of the shelter. And so it's very natural at all. That's not rectilinear or geometric, but is much more organic. I love these hats that you see all over, not so much anymore, but the traditional hats that were worn in Thailand. They're called a gnob, G-N-O-B. And they are reflecting both a kind of shape that comes from shedding the water, protecting your face and your shoulders from the sun. But at the same time, they're reflecting the materials they're made out of, which is this very supple reed that they're weaving together. And those forms are taking a natural form that the reed, when it's woven, takes, but also a form that reflects the physiognomy of the head, not quite round, but sort of round like our head, and the size and extent required to give the prerequisite shade and protection from rain. So we see that in many, many aspects of that culture, that it's sticking around there, but you even see it in the very most monumental buildings. These are great temples. They're Buddhist temples. And there was a particular kind of dance that women did in Thailand, have done for ages. You can still see these traditional dances in fancy hotels or something. But the women would let their fingernails grow really long, and there was a real gracefulness of the way the hand moved and the way those fingernails arched off the hand. And that beautiful gesture in human grace and physiognomy then found its way into the buildings in a kind of ornament that had that same organic grace to it. In these great stupas, which are also Buddhist religious buildings, we see in the general shape of it a kind of organic shape. In fact, there are ants in this area that build great clay mounds. That's their homes, and they tend to make them in a shape like this. It's a shape that structurally reflects the way that mud or that any kind of masonry would get smaller at the top and slowly larger and larger and larger as it gets a foundation at the bottom. So that there's something just natural and organic about the way the general building is shaped. It also is shaped by a ritual in Buddhist religion, which is circumambulation, so that you would walk around these stupas and you ring bells, and so that shape is about human movement. And then as you look at detail on the building, you see human forms, you see vegetative forms, and again, there is an inspiration for the character of this building from natural, organic, biological sources of form. Now, there are periods of time when this becomes ascendant. There are periods of time when it's not so prominent in a culture or in a place. One of those periods of time when we were particularly attuned to this was the latter part of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century in Europe in particular. And this was a period, we've talked about it a little before, where there was a rejection of traditional art forms and traditional architectural forms. So we talked about Manet rebelling against the salons in Paris. This is the period just kind of after that, and maybe the rebellion's a little more mature at this point. So in the late 19th century, in the painting on the left by Edvard Munch, a famous Norwegian painter, he's depicting the landscape, but now he's not just depicting it literally, he's kind of abstracting it and seeing shapes or forms or feelings that come out of the natural character of the landscape. So at, you know, the horizon becomes not so significant what's really significant is the light of the sky and how that light reflects in the water and the shapes and colors that come out of that, or the landscape and how it interlocks with the water and the shapes and colors of that. So he's looking at the landscape not just literally, but now finding an abstracted set of forms that come from the landscape. Similar kind of thing happening in Henri Rousseau's painting, The Dream, of 10 years or so later, where he goes down to the South Pacific and he's going into these very exotic environments, and he's, in a way, almost like a biologist, observing similarities of shape or form in different biological elements in that environment. So we see the kind of pointed fronds of this plant, which we would call mother-in-law tongue, probably not what they called it there. How is that similar to grasses that have a kind of shape like that, or other flowers that have a shape like that? How is that similar, say, to the fingers or the toes, which are particularly elongated on the woman and have that long, thin, tapered shape as well? How are the round shapes of her breast similar to the round shapes of the fruits, similar to the round shapes of the eyes of the tigers there? He's again, like a biologist, kind of classifying shapes and forms that he can see in nature and making a harmonious visual composition out of those. Now, the point of this is these guys finding forms that are inspirational for their painting in nature, not literally depicting those forms, but finding a taxonomy or a vocabulary of forms from nature. And at that same time, there begins to be a whole movement, which we now call Art Nouveau, or a new art. That is, not the way art used to be made, but now we've got a new way of making art that took literal natural things and abstracted them in various ways. So at the beginning, you get something like these legs of that table, which look a lot like insect legs that get kind of thick and then taper and get thin. So inspired by a natural form, but not literally that form. You get vegetative forms as ornament in here, but in a way just making a texture, not so much meant to be identified as vegetative forms. You get in the work of, there's a wonderful furniture designer, Hector Guimard, that does these freaking amazing pieces of furniture where he's looking at the wood and he understands there's grain in the wood. And so they're kind of linear shapes and forms that naturally come of that wood. And he's looking at the metal. And metal is this fluid material. When it's hot, it's liquid. It flows. Why would we put it in a geometric shape? Its intrinsic nature is to be liquid, fluid. And how can I make that grain of the wood and the liquid quality of metal all work together to make this chest? I love the drawer pulls on the right, where the grain of the wood just comes out. And it unites with that, again, human physiognomy. Our hand grabbing that and pulling it. And you can see almost the stretch marks. When I pull that drawer, it pulls away from the grain of the wood. And it's uniting both the function and our human interaction with it and the nature of the material and the wood and making a really unique and powerful form out of that. At times in Art Nouveau, the pieces of furniture almost look like they could walk. I mean, they're so animate. They're so like a creature because they've drawn their shapes and forms from biology, nature, organisms. And that was in something as diverse as a sofa, which is all about reclining and comfort and embracing and a kind of womb-like feeling there, all the way to something like a tray, which now, instead of being rectilinear, takes those inspirations from more organic forms. And some of that comes across to the United States, where There are working glass and lamps and things like that that begin to come out of shapes of like vegetation and flowers. On the left, I love this one in particular because it's prickly pear. This looks like a real Texas lamp here. Prickly pear, and the fruits of the prickly pear become the light fixtures on that lamp. Or this one, which is not identifiable as any particular vegetative form, but no doubt it's about a kind of flower and a stem and the graceful forms that come of that. Now, it's kind of hard at first to say, well, how does that translate into architecture? Because, when you're starting to make a building, it's not maybe as simple as making a smaller thing organic like this. And there's lots of money invested in buildings, and wouldn't it be expensive to do these more organic forms? I think there was caution about that. But you begin to get architects like Charles Rennie Mackintosh, a Scottish architect, who starts verging into this. And he was a great illustrator. He was wonderful at watercolors. And he actually did illustrations for a lot of biology books. And he would illustrate in a very scientific and analytical way the exact nature of that lily, what its stems were like, what its leaves were like, what its petals were like, the pistils and stamens. And he's understanding that completely, but he's also looking beyond the science to say, what makes that so beautiful? Those sinuous lines, what can I draw from that? And at about the same time as he's doing those analytical drawings, he's designing this wallpaper for Miss Cranston's tea room, a little restaurant he was designing in Glasgow. And you can see those sinuous lines and those delicate linear forms inspiring his design for that wallpaper, as well as the female human figure and her hair and the kind of linear flowing quality of her hair and the kind of linear flowing quality of the lilies, and all of that comes together now beginning to make architecture. But it's really more in his furniture, where you can see how that might get translated into a building. And you see these tapered, linear, graceful, elegant forms making a little table, making a chair. He also designed flatware, silverware, that had some of those same qualities that he admired so much in those lilies he was looking at. The same guy who did that furniture, Hector Guimard, began to look at buildings. He was an architect, and he did the whole Paris metro system, all of the initial stations for the Paris metro, and those are still many of them there in the core of Paris. And he had urban stations like this that kind of looked like some kind of stem and flower, and that flower became the light fixture, and the branches became a kind of arch that then took you down in there, and the handrail is actually almost like a hedge being grown along there to make a more graceful, soft. You're going down underground. It's going to get a little nasty down there, but there's a kind of natural, soft, gracious feeling as you go into the subway. Or here, one of the metro stations that was in a park, and it's incredibly delicate, like almost like a spider's web there, or something, or the wing of a butterfly. Light and delicate and natural and much more organic. And this was the beginning of Art Nouveau architecture. So Hector Guimard was one of the real pioneers of Art Nouveau architecture and one of its best known proponents. A couple of other buildings by Hector Guimard. This was an apartment building that he did in the 16th arrondissement in Paris. And you can see elements of the traditional arch and columns. But now these columns are not so much geometric. They're like they're growing out of the base and growing into the top there. And the gate that's inside there is made out of metal. And we're seeing it from the inside there. And it's that luscious, flowing, lyrical quality of vegetation Because the metal is liquid, we can pour it. We can make it into these soft organic shapes. You can see them doing it in the stonework here, where the stonework, instead of being sort of traditional geometric arches, now it's just this kind of slow, curvilinear opening that thickens and thins, and the forces move kind of gracefully and naturally around the door, but the shapes of all the pieces of stone are very organic and irregular. And then toward the end of his career, Guimard starts thinking, could I do the whole damn building this way? Could I make the plan organic? Could I make it so that you're kind of swept into the building and then there's a very irregular shaped open hallway and then you're swept up the stair, and that every room, every function in the building, why do we make them rectilinear? Why couldn't we make them softer, cave-like, organic? And he never got this one built, but it was in his head, the idea that you might be able to do this. The guy who made it happen, however, was Antonio Gaudí. And Gaudí would have been, you know, he's often classified as an Art Nouveau architect. He's so kind of idiosyncratic and kinky that he's often seen as a kind of just individual. He's just alone. He's apart from other architects. But in fact, he's part of this lineage and this spirit of that era, rejecting traditional forms and saying, can we make more like nature? Can we really learn from nature? And it came from the soul of Antonio Gaudí. He loved nature, and he was a real student of nature. He loved to take hikes. He was quite a hiker. And he also loved his region. He just loved the landscape and the beauty of the area around Barcelona where he lived. So that's what we now call Catalan. And he was politically, he was very very invested in the independence and the identity of Catalan, had its own slightly different language. And he loved the landscape around Catalan and in Catalan and around Barcelona. And so he became a kind of student of that region. And as a student of the region, he then thought, well, our buildings ought to reflect the character of our place. Our place has made the culture. The building should reinforce the sense of place that we can see in the landscape of Catalan. So in the Casa Mila, this apartment building that he does in a newly developing area on kind of the, what were the outskirts at that point of Barcelona, we see him making this apartment building really along a lot of those principles that we saw Hector Guimard dreaming about but not able to pull off. But here he's thinking of the seacoast. Of course, that's a major element of living in Barcelona or in Catalan. You're on the Mediterranean. It's one of the most beautiful areas of the Mediterranean. And that seacoast is so memorable and so much a part of the culture and the place. So in a way, he's making the Casa Mila like it's a great cliff on the edge of the sea, maybe worn away by centuries of turf pounding away at it and hollowing out these courtyards on the inside and making irregular, wavy forms on the face of the building. He described it as just a big, worn rock of a building. And it's actually made out of stone, so the material it's being made out of is almost in its natural state, almost like you see stone in nature, and not more like you see stone in a more man-made, manufactured way. So it's not only the seacoast and the waves and the irregular coastline and the eroded rocks that are inspiring Casa Mila, but there also is a mountain just outside Barcelona that's a very distinctive mountain. It's called Montserrat. And it's like that comes from serrated. It's very jagged at the top of Montserrat. And when you see it, it's a blowaway. It just doesn't look like any other mountain you've ever seen. And this was one of Gaudí's favorite places to go hike, was in Montserrat. It's accessible from Barcelona, but kind of a hike out there. And he loved Montserrat. So the top of Casa Mila has that kind of form of Montserrat. these series of jagged elements that engage with the sky. So he's relating to specific forms in the region, the forms of Montserrat, the forms of the coastline, but he's also making things that make good sense in terms of their function. The courtyards, it's a hot climate. The courtyard is a wonderful way for the heat to come out of the apartments and kind of rise up there and create a vertical stack effect to ventilate the building. These little towers actually were ventilation shafts that went down through the building. As you can see, they have holes in them at the top. And they also were ways of ventilating the building. So it was the movement of air that was also giving a kind of functional driver for those now very organic and natural forms. It's also the function of people moving through the building. When you walk up a staircase, that's a kind of graceful vertical move. Why shouldn't that look like the graceful vertical move of the body moving up like that? It shouldn't be mechanical. It should be loose and lyrical. And that's how the corridors and the movement places are very loose and organic. And then it boils all the way down to details. Here you see that rock work made in, very carefully formed rock work, but then made to go back almost in its natural kind of characteristic with smooth, soft curves and very rough finish on the outside. And then where he needs to make a balcony, holy moly, these balconies, it's like seaweed just washed up on the rock. And they literally look like seaweed. And they're made out of metal, which is a much more liquid material. And they grab onto the side here, but they make a handrail for the balconies. So, and sometimes it gets even a little more literal, and sometimes it's a little more abstract, but everything drawing on nature for its form. And in the end, this exciting, crazy, wild, lovable building, and one that from the very beginning, extremely popular place to live. I mean, that was a prestige address in Casamila. And to this day, very, very prestigious building in the city, and helped to make Antonio Gaudí and any of you who visited Barcelona, when they think of, what does a visitor see in Barcelona? You see Gaudí. When the Olympics were in Barcelona a number of years ago, they just the television cameras just focused on Gaudí buildings, Gaudí buildings, Gaudí buildings. They're kind of signature of what is this city is about. What is the region about? All of that pride of place gets embedded in the buildings because they are learning from and they're inspired by the region. Wonderful opportunity Gaudí got in the early part of the 20th century. He had done a large home for one of the most wealthy families in Barcelona, the Güell family. And then the Güell family, that was early in his career, actually, he got a lot better. That's maybe not one of his better works. It's a very big, very lavish house. But as he became known as an architect, the Güell family were one of his great patrons. And they wanted to give a park back to the city. And they owned a nice piece of land kind of at the edge of the city. And they donated it to the city as a park. And they hired Gaudí to be the architect to design this park. Well, what could be more wonderful if you're an architect that loves nature than to design a park? So it's a very thoroughly designed park, but it also is very integral with the natural environment of that landscape there. So there are hills that are just at the edge of Barcelona. That sort of is the edge of the city. And as the hill comes up, he actually takes the slope of the hill and flattens it out to make a big plaza here, and then tucks under there a marketplace, which would be the kind of center function of the park. And here we are on that plaza looking out to the Mediterranean, and as you see that sort of curvilinear, irregular coastline, you see the kind of curvilinear, irregular edge to that plaza. So there we are with the marketplace that's in the shades, hot climate, wonderful covered market down below. At the edge, we see this wavy line that's like the coastline, and you see in the distance the coastline beyond. that kind of whimsical curvilinear shape. Also actually is very good for the function there. It's a place for people to sit and chat. And so it makes little niches and little conversation areas around the edge of this plaza, and then leaves the center of the plaza open for more undifferentiated and flexible kinds of things to happen. So as you're there, you might see a young couple necking in one of these little niches. Very organic, sort of the bodies entwined and the architecture curving around them. I don't know, it just was really beautiful to see this couple making out like crazy in this really, beautiful, soft, curvilinear environment. And then there are moments in Park Gui where you see things quite literally. This is in the region there, they have lots of lizards. And the lizards are kind of mascots for this area. So he literally makes a lizard here in these tiles and bright colors. And out the lizard's mouth is the water fountain. And that's where you wash your hands after you've been at the market and eaten your piece of fruit. There's a little bit of water there that comes literally out of this lizard's mouth. And over and over, there are just these inventive plays on nature. So that, which if you just look briefly, you kind of think, well, is that a cliff? And the mountain continues up here. And in fact, is the mountain's going up here, and it's kind of rugged and rocky. And then at the bottom, Gaudi makes a building that is rugged and rocky and cliff-like. But in fact, in between each of those, there's a shop. So the bottom down here is all ice cream shop and retail. But you're in a park, so it feels like a park. But it also is the kinds of things you want as services in the park. So these people are going in to get their ice cream or get their whatever they need for their picnic in the park. On the right-hand side, you see similarly, this is an arcade behind there. It's at a rocky cliff, and he's making these big boulder-like gestures that hold up the mountain, allow for this function to happen inside that. But very rugged and tough, like that rugged, tough, almost desert landscape around there. On this wonderful arcade that is, instead of just a regular arch, which, yeah, it makes some structural sense, but this is where the mountain is coming down and those forces are actually at an angle, so the columns are at an angle and the arch is kind of swayed back that way. Looser, freer, more like a cave. Is it a building? Is it a cave? There's a blurring between the way nature makes forms and the way human beings make forms. So that wonderful use of the region and the landscape and the vegetation and even the wildlife, all of those things inspiring a really particular kind of architecture that says a lot about that place and has endeared itself amazingly to the people there. So that's one way to look at architecture, is more from the region point of view. There are other architects that have gotten very organic sources of form, more particularly from the site where they're building. And in this case, this is a student union building. It's at the Technical University in Otaniemi. Otaniemi is a small town outside of Helsinki, kind of a suburb of Helsinki. And this is really, really prestigious, kind of the MIT of Finland. And it was a start-from-scratch campus that was begun in the 50s and 60s, and by 1966, when this building is built, there's a handful of buildings on the campus. They had a big competition, and people made entries to see how would we do this very important building at the center of the campus, which was the student union. And it was won by a husband and wife team, Raima and Riley Pietila. And it really looked, these people went out to the site and they just sussed out, what is this site about and how can I make a building just grow out of the site? And three things were really striking to them. For one thing, there are all these granite boulders that are just outcroppings on the site. And that's pretty common in this area of Finland. It's a glaciated area where when the glaciers left, they kind of pulled out these big granite rocks sometimes and scraped away the granite. And so you'll get these big granite outcroppings and sometimes these boulders that just sit around in the landscape. And this particular site had a lot of that. And so at the base of the building, they made these just big granite boulders, like the boulders on the site. And then the site was very wooded, and they wanted to keep just as many trees as they possibly could on the site. So you can see they left a lot of the trees and kind of nestled the building within the trees. And the particular kind of tree that were there, some of them were pines and some of them are birch trees. But birches and pines, as say, very different than live oaks. Live oaks are gnarly and fat and spread out. Whereas birches and pines, very tall vertical trees. And hardly any branching at the bottom. And then usually a canopy at the top. But actually when you look through the forest, it was pretty transparent. And then there would be a canopy that was over you. So they noticed that and they thought of these long, tall trees. And they made a middle portion of the building that has vertical wood pieces and is pretty transparent. And that's pretty much where the windows are in the building. And then at the top, they made a big canopy, like the canopy of the forest. And they made it out of copper. The copper turns a kind of dark green. And that green would be very sympathetic to the green of the canopy in the forest. So in a way, they're just asking the site, how would you make a building? How would you start? Well, you'd start with these granite boulders. And then when you wanted openness, how would you get that? Well, you'd make verticals, but you'd leave it unobstructed otherwise. And then how would you make shelter over it? Well, you'd make the canopy like you have in the trees. And that's pretty much what the Dipoli Student Union looks like. It's a combination of those three layers that go into making the building. Then you can see those verticals of the trees reflected very strongly in the verticals of the windows there. You can see those huge granite outcroppings in nature, then turning out to big granite outcroppings in the base of the building, and just a kind of slow bleed from nature into the man-made environment. And then the plan of the building tended to be these kind of irregular embracing pieces that would hollow out a little exterior area in the middle of the building so that there could be lots of orientation to little courts and exterior spaces. This one's a particularly beautiful one. It's cold so much of the year in Finland, they value enormously those days when you can go outside and be in the sun and be in nature. And this one's oriented right to the south so that it catches every ray of sun. And on a beautiful day, people just flock into that. So there is the possibility of real, literal engagement with nature by the plan of the building. And even when you're inside, there is that connectivity back to nature. So here we're in that, where you see the vertical trunks of the trees, and then beyond you see the vertical trunks of the trees outside. Put a planter in there so that you actually can grow the vegetation up there so it literally looks like the vegetation outside on the site and blurs the boundary between inside and outside. And all of that really, really important in a place like Finland, where any connection with nature is really valued because they have to stay indoors so much of the year and it's cold so much of the year. But there is the ability to be in that dining room and look out, have the rocks sort of make a defining element of the terrace there, but then see beyond and into the trees that they left on the site and engaging with nature. And then in another point, really the kind of lower level where those rocks come into the building and you feel like your space inside is defined in exactly the same way as those spaces outside are defined by the rocks. So a second really important way for nature, biology, and organisms to enter into a building is to really have that direct engagement with a natural site where a building is located. A third way of thinking about this is that it may not really have anything to do with a region, or it may not have anything to do with a site, but we're getting this from just maybe function, just from the way people move, the way people sit, or some particular function that is particularly organic or dynamic. And that would definitely be the case in the TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport, done originally by Earl Saarinen in the 1950s. It now is JetBlue's hub at Kennedy Airport. And it was built in an era way back in the 1950s when flight was freaking amazing. I mean, this was the terminal where the first transatlantic flights, the regular carriers across the Atlantic, left. So it was a really amazing thing to be able to not take an ocean liner over the ocean, but to be able to take these airplanes. And flying was not an everyday affair like it is now, but it was a kind of phenomenal affair. You could get in this airplane and be lighter than air, and like a bird, you could take off into the sky. So the building, in a way, is talking about this magical capability of flying. And in some ways, the building looks like a kind of bird, or maybe like a flying dragon. It takes literally some of the movements, you swooping up in your car and swooping into the building and then being kind of sucked in that entry portal. And the shapes of the concrete, again, concrete, this fluid element, it starts liquid. And so you leave it in liquid, fluid forms. You don't make it into blocky rectilinear forms, which maybe is against its nature. It's heavy, it's solid, it's fluid. And those kinds of forms are what's making the shape of the building. When you go inside, then the stair is not some regimented straight thing. It's again, sweeping you up into the building. You're being sucked into these kind of tunnels that take you out to the airplanes and into jetways that take you into the airplanes. And so it's all about that dynamic, fluid movement of people. And then eventually you get on an airplane and that dynamic, fluid movement of going into the sky. This amazing lifting, defying gravity. And the building gives that sense of defying gravity and moving into the air. Sometimes it's not quite as dramatic a functional thing. In this case, this is a science museum in Wolfsburg in Germany. The architect is Zaha Hadid, very famous contemporary architect. This is one she did several years ago. And again, this building is really all about movement. In fact, the director of the museum showed me around it a few years after it was built, and he said, we chose Zaha Hadid because her buildings seem to be all about movement. And we realized that both the site and the program seem to demand that this building be about movement. We've got all these kids that come in a school bus, and they come in hordes, and they're jamming into the building and going up into it and moving around the exhibits, and it was all very fluid. Why not have an architecture that had that kind of movement embedded in it? The building is also on a site that people were accustomed to cutting through that site. And if you plopped a building down in the middle of it, it would interrupt the movement of people in the city. So Zaha Hadid lifted it up off the ground and allow those paths of movement to continue under so that people in their directions going from one part of the city to the other are constantly walking in and through and around the building on the lower floor. And then if you're a patron to the building, you're moved in one of those legs that goes down, and then you're swept up this escalator, and again, this sort of fluid movement up into the space of the building itself, which everywhere is about fluidity and dynamism and movement. And the floor moves up and down, and the ceiling moves up and down, and the walls move in and out. And it's like the surging and moving of all these people wandering around, looking at exhibits, and the natural biological forces of people as organic beings are now translated into the building. So this is a little lobby going into an amphitheater where you watch a film, and it's the floor turns into the wall, turns into the ceiling, a little perch for a seat over there, but it's sweeping people into that, and there's a constant movement, in, out, And the movement is what's being depicted in the shape of the building. And that's pretty much everywhere. And it's an exciting place. You're looking down and up, and there's groups of kids clumped over here and some clumped over there and moving and changing. And it feels like the building really is a reflection of the function and the activities that are going on inside. And we're going to close today with, just as we closed last time, with a building that seemed to incorporate all of those motivations for numbers, mathematics, and geometry. In this case, we're looking for a building that is incorporating multiple of these notions of what generates natural, biological, organic shapes. So, in some ways, I think the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, in Spain, by Frank Gehry, is really reflective of the region where it is. And you guys saw the film on Gehry, and you remember, you know, his descriptions. He talks a little bit about Bilbao there. But in this case, the region around there was not a tourist destination. It was a kind of industrial part of Spain. And part of the goal was to make some tourist destinations so there could be other more diversified economic bases for this region. So they were looking to make a place that really, in a way, what Gaudí did for Barcelona, could Gehry begin to do for Bilbao? So it was a very ambitious notion that we would make this important museum that would endear itself to people locally, but also kind of have a conversation with visitors as they came. So the region around there is known for two things in particular. One is it's known for shipbuilding. So they have built ships forever and ever in that area. It's a coastal city, and actually there's the coast, and there's a river that comes in, and Bilbao is on the river near the mouth of that river with the Atlantic Ocean. So shipbuilding had been a big part of it. And there's something in the building that seems like a big ship. It's the kind of thing they've been building here in that part of Spain over centuries. The second big industry in this area is fishing. They're very famous for their fishing and for all kinds of fish. Their cuisine is based almost totally on seafood. They have a fantastic cuisine in that area, wonderful food with all kinds of exotic fish that we don't get over here, but that they have as staples over there. Gehry also, it turns out, was this fish fanatic. The guy's got a fish fetish. And he's just fascinated by, and when you think about it, fish are amazing. They've got these scales. They give a wonderful texture, and sometimes they're almost iridescent. They shine and they shimmer, and the kind of water and reflections that happen there, and the scales of the fish. It's a beautiful combination, and then just the way the fish's form moves to swim. I mean, Gehry's just all over this, and even long before he did Bilbao, he was interested in fish, and he did lamps that were made like fish, and he did lattice pavilions that were made like fish, in a way just like we were seeing someone like Charles Rennie Mackintosh looking at the lily and being inspired by forms in the lily to make forms that could translate into a chair or a piece of cutlery or a building. So we see Frank Gehry fascinated by fish, and very relevant in this case because it's a city and it's a region that is very heavily based in fish. So there's something in the museum in Bilbao also that identifies with that region and the fish that are there. In fact, there's one long gallery along here that Gehry refers to as the fish gallery. I mean, that one it's a fish as far as he's concerned. So it's the region, and that's certainly inspiring it. It also is the site here. This is where the river is coming into Bilbao from the sea. The ocean is down at the bottom of the slide here. The river is coming in, and it bends right here and goes into the rest of the city. And right where that bend is, that's where the museum is. And there is, this is the river. There's, he builds a pool to reflect an extension of the river, but he also shapes the building around that curve so it reflects not just the region, but the site, the adjacency to the water on the site, the bend in the river that's making a shape to the building on the site. So it's organic in its relation to the region. It's organic in relation to its site. And then it's beginning to do these riffs off of all of those shapes and forms. And you get this loose, lyrical quality. You're getting textures that are like the texture of the fish's scales. You're getting colors, the silvery quality. You're getting reflections like the reflection of the water, the river, the ocean in this area. All of these things begin to shape the form of the building. In addition, it is the movement of people that also shapes the building. So you here's the river wrapping around like that, and that's making the kind of bow of the building. You come to the building from the city like this, down a flight of stairs or a ramp, and enter the building right there. And then there's a kind of mixmaster lobby. And from that lobby, then you swing out to the fish gallery over here, or to these other kind of odd-shaped galleries, or sometimes to more rectilinear galleries through there. But it's spokes, just exactly like when you're visiting the museum. You go and you check your coat and you get your ticket and you meet your friends and you lay out a strategy, and then you go into this gallery and then you come back and you kind of recombobulate, and then you go into this gallery and you come back, and it's a very clear functional diagram of how you move through the museum. And even the qualities of some of those spaces have the same kind of loose fluid movement that seems very natural in a museum. And that then gets borne out in three dimensions and in materials. The big lobby space is high and tall and looks out to the water and engages with the natural environment and makes you think out, looking away. And then you go into the galleries and they're much more enclosed and more focused on the art and more internal. One of the times I was there, there was an exhibit of Calder sculpture. And, oh my God, the looseness of the Calder sculpture, which is all about letting the breeze move it slowly, about hanging delicately, and there's something very organic and natural and lyrical about that. And somehow in that space, those Calder sculptures looked 10 times better than anywhere else I've seen them. They had a resonance with the building. Now, just to let you know that that's... Gary is... I don't know. I think maybe he slipped off the cliff a little bit after Bilbao in some ways, and that people got so enamored of those forms, they started cropping up maybe in places they didn't make quite so much sense as they did in Bilbao. Bilbao is where he invented them. And in a way, he got this vocabulary out of really wonderful, authentic things there. And I think another place where we see that working pretty well is in the Disney Concert Hall, where if it's offices, if it's just, you know, regular, repetitive, static functions, then we get a regular, repetitive, static building. And that is a significant part of the Disney Concert Hall. And where it interfaces with the grid of the city, we get that kind of geometric relationship. But then it's a place for music. And there's a moment where, no, this building is not about static. It's not about repetitive. It's about something lyrical and wonderful and soft. And it's about people sweeping into there and milling around in the lobby and the shapes and sounds of the music within it. It's about a little sub-area where the chamber orchestra can play and about the big area where the big orchestra plays. And it also is about, this building's fantastic because you can kind of walk on top of it and you go in between those forms. And there's a whole park up there that is about a whole set of activities and a quiet place in the city and getting away from the city and wandering and meandering through these big natural forms, and then stumbling onto a little ensemble playing there, or stumbling onto a little amphitheater where a group of musicians are playing. Just this wonderful ad hoc, loose environment that's all the roofscape of the Disney Concert Hall. And all of that also incorporated in the interior, where there also are these places to wander and places to focus and places for informal playing of music and more formal playing of music and for people to gather and people to disperse. So there's shades again of what I think is so wonderful in Bilbao. If you start to then make those forms just universally applicable, and they're not tied to a region or a site or a function, they lose a lot of their vitality. But in these two buildings, I think they're just magnificent. Okay, Twitter card question for today. Little bit of a slight difference from what we've been doing. So I want to know, I'm always interested in your own predilections, your own responses. And I've told you before many times, I'm not trying to cram this down your throat. I don't care if you hate Gary. I don't care if you love Gary. I don't care if you hate Zaha Hadid or you love Zaha Hadid or you thought that building sucks or that building was great. I want you to have your own perception of it. So if you take the lecture last time on numbers, mathematics, and geometry, and the lecture this time on organic sources of form, and let's say you have 100 points, and you said in the whole built world, how many points do I want to give? How many votes do I want to give for organic architecture? Or how many votes do I want to give for numbers, mathematics, and geometry? Would I like, in an ideal environment that I would love to live my life in, would it be 70% numbers, mathematics, and geometry, and 30% nature, biology, and organisms? Or would it be 90% nature, biology, and organisms, and 10% numbers, mathematics, and geometry? So think of why you might have those predilections and tell me the ratio that you think should be in the world you imagine to be supportive of you and why you think that would be the case. Just one more word. Remember, we do not have class on Tuesday. The tours on Saturday replace that class. The next class will be Thursday, which is when we have our exams.